Right. So these are two. I'm going to tell you about these two topics: quantum thermalization and many-body Anderson localization, which are opposites of each other, as I'll tell you. And I realize now this is actually an introduction to some of the topics that's going to be in the conference here. What, in 2 weeks, right? Yeah. So people who are interested and want to hear more. You'll have an opportunity soon. So this is very basic quantum statistical mechanics stuff. And so I view this lecture, at least a fair amount of this lecture, as a class you should have had in your quantum statistical mechanics course. But it's generally not discussed in the textbooks because it's issues that people haven't really focused on until quite recently. And I'll kind of explain to you why. So we just posted a review article here just last, I guess earlier this month, since it's still April, with Rahul, postdoc in PCTS at Princeton. And then this other paper here, this PhysRevB paper, has all these five authors. This is a subject that I've been working. It was Vadim Oganessian, who's at City University of New York, who got me into this subject about 10 years ago, and we've been working on it a lot since then. Arijit Pal is a student who he was my graduate student who did his thesis on many-body localization, and Shivaji's my colleague at Princeton. Okay. So, like you do in thermostat MET courses, let's consider a closed system, fully isolated from its environment, and let's put inside there a quantum system, and we're going to take the quantumness of it very seriously today, of a quantum system of many interacting degrees of freedom, right? And the degrees of freedom could be spins, they could be ultra-cold atoms or molecules or ions, they could be qubits. They could be electrons in a condensed matter system, or whatever. And the reason we're revisiting this topic, which of course is an ancient topic, is because, well, two reasons really. There's really two things going on here, which is atomic and molecular, AMO physics, atomic molecular optical physics, is becoming many-body physics. You know, it used to be atomic physicists have studied atoms, individual atoms, whereas now atomic physicists put many atoms in a trap and do real many-body physics, right? And they're doing it with the tools of modern atomic physics and lasers, and so they can really make a very good approximation to a system like this of many degrees of freedom, strongly interacting with each other, well isolated from the environment. And then another sort of thread motivating this is at least certain ways of thinking about possible quantum information processing or storage. You know, you think of things like this, right? You want to have your qubits isolated from the environment. You want them to at least sometimes interact with each other so they can do something interesting. So that's another sort of line of research which is pointing towards looking at these questions seriously. Of quantum statistical mechanics. There's another line, which has actually been going for quite a while in high energy physics, thinking about black holes, entanglement issues around black holes, et cetera. But today, first of all, I know nothing about that, and so today, this is all going to be non-relativistic in flat space. And I also, my system, I want to do a system where there is a real space and the interactions between my degrees of freedom are short range in real space. So we have a spatial structure and a concept of locality in real space so that we can do localization. Whoops, wrong way. Okay. One of the first sort of really interesting statements on this topic is in Phil Anderson's original paper about localization. What was Anderson thinking about in 1958? So semiconductors were new then, and people would dope things into semiconductors. In particular, they'd put in dopants which had spins on them. No mobile carriers, just spins. And the spins interact with each other by dipole interactions or super exchange. And people would do resonance experiments on those spins and ask, you know, what's the line width? You know, what are the dephasing processes, et cetera? So that was sort of basic physics, which was being looked at in the 50s. And so Anderson proposed the following. Let's just consider the spins in an insulating solid. They're at random positions, so it's a random system. And let's consider just the interactions between the spins and maybe also an interaction with an applied magnetic static applied magnetic field. But neglect the spin-phonon interactions. So here we have, you know, if we say something isolated from its environment, we're making the approximation that these spins interact more strongly with each other than with the phonons, which often is true. And let's make the approximation of ignoring the spin-phonon interactions. And he was working, thinking about on the energy scale of the spin-spin interactions, energies that represented high temperatures, right? So this is a condensed matter type talk I'm giving you today, but it's different from many condensed matter talks in that I'm not interested in the ground state, I'm not interested in being at low temperatures, I'm interested in very highly excited states that you might think were just classical, but I'm going to take their quantum dynamics seriously. So Anderson asked this question, does this system of spins all by themselves constitute a reservoir or heat bath that thermally equilibrates its parts and causes the spins to all relax to a thermal equilibrium? That was the question he was asking. And that's a yes-no question, and there's two answers, and the two answers are the two topics of my lecture today. If yes, if the system actually is a reservoir for itself, that's what we call thermalization. But he proposed that this didn't have to happen, that even though the spins were interacting with each other, they might not constitute a reservoir and thermally equilibrate. They might actually remember their initial conditions forever. And that was Anderson localization, right? And that's what we now call many-body Anderson localization to distinguish it from other variants of Anderson localization that have received much more attention over the years since then. Okay, so we have these two possibilities. Our system can thermalize itself, or our system is not a bath, and so it can't thermalize itself, and our system is isolated from the environment, so it doesn't thermalize, and it remembers its initial conditions forever, and that's localization. And as we change, say, the energy of the system or the amount of randomness in the system, you can actually have a new type of quantum phase transition between these two possibilities, thermal to localized. And I'm going to be talking about this phase transition as well today. And although this was implicit in Anderson's paper, it didn't receive much attention until this paper here, Bosco, Elena, Altschuler, 2006, brought this whole subject back to a lot of people's attention. And it was at that point that we started working on it. And as I said, my student, Arijit Pal, did some nice work on it, which I'm going to refer to. And we have a paper in 2010. It's a quantum phase. It's a phase transition. It can happen. Fortunately, it happens even in one dimension, which makes it easier for us to study it numerically. And it can happen in one dimensions at high temperatures. Right? So this violates the, you know, those of you who know some statistical mechanics know the Landau-Pyles theorem, which says there's no phase transitions at non-zero temperature in one dimensions. But this doesn't violate the theorem. It violates the assumptions of the theorem, because the assumption of the theorem, when you prove that theorem, you assume equilibrium statistical mechanics applies to your system. And what this phase transition is a phase transition where equilibrium statistical mechanics stops working for your system. So it violates that theorem not by the theorem being wrong, but by violating the assumptions of the theorem. And theorems always only have assumptions. They're not universally true. They're only true when their assumptions are true. please interrupt with questions. Okay, a little review of quantum mechanics. So let's start over here, quantum mechanics review. Okay, so when we teach quantum mechanics and learn quantum mechanics, there's a tendency to focus on pure states or wave functions. Unfortunately, too much of a tendency. Okay, so here's a pure state, a ket, or we could represent it by a wave function, and its dynamics is given by the Schrödinger equation if we have a system with a Hamiltonian. So, you know, I'm assuming it's a closed system with a Hamiltonian. And this can be solved by just unitary time evolution with this operator, e to the minus iht, although that's, it sounds simple, but it isn't. Now, if we have such a state, the probabilities in that state, what I like to call the probability operator, is given by this construction here, the ket times the bra as in this order. So that's an operator, a projection onto that state. And this is the probabilities in that state, what's called the density operator, or the density matrix. Right? Now, if we're talking about a many-body system, which I am, you can't really, in a laboratory, prepare a pure state for a many-body system with many degrees of freedom. You know, atomic physicists might be good, but they're not that good yet. And they probably never will be. So many-body pure states really cannot be prepared when we talk about many degrees of freedom. So more realistically, our system is in a mixed state, which is a where the probability is given by a statistical sum, a probabilistic, you know, just a classical sum of a bunch of pure states, which is normalized to have total probability 1. So then our system, we could have our, so we prepare our system in some initial state, isolate it from the environment, right? In the state preparation, typically your system becomes entangled with other degrees of freedom in the environment. That's why you have a mixed state when you prepare some initial state. Now you isolate it from the environment, right? You might have evaporatively cooled your atoms, and you know the atoms that went out are still entangled with the ones inside. But now you just isolated the ones left in your trap, close the system, you have a Hamiltonian, and it undergoes unitary time evolution just like this. So the mixed state just evolves just like any operator, unitary time evolution. Okay, and I'm working here in the Schrödinger picture where the states evolve and the operators don't, although the state itself is an operator. But the other operators don't. Okay. Okay. Now, a standard assumption when you do thermodynamics or statistical mechanics is you take your system, isolate it from the environment, wait a long time, it will go to equilibrium. That's a common assumption that's made. So equilibrium statistical mechanics for such a system will correctly describe the long-time behavior of that system, right? Okay. But then let's just pause and ask, what does this statement really mean when we're talking about a closed quantum many-body system that's undergoing unitary time evolution? It does not mean the full system goes to thermal equilibrium, right? Because under unitary time evolution, the state of the full system does not go to something like a Boltzmann-Gibbs ensemble or a microcanonical ensemble or one of the standard ensembles for doing equilibrium statistical mechanics. On the contrary, all detailed information about the initial state that was in this operator, rho of zero, remains in this operator at later times because all that's happening is unitary time evolution, right? It's just a rotation in some sense in Hilbert space, or you know, roughly speaking. But that information, although it's still there in the state at late times, it gets hidden, becoming essentially in the limit of a many-body system impossible to measure as time goes to infinity. So the information, which might be in some simple observable, goes into some very complicated operator, which is essentially impossible to measure. And that's what we call decoherence. It isn't that the information is lost, it's really just being hidden. Okay. When we ask, what does it mean for a system to go to thermal equilibrium, a closed quantum system to go to thermal equilibrium, what really thermalizes are just subsystems of the full system. And what thermalization means is the full system is acting as a reservoir to thermalize its subsystems. Okay? And you might ask, what does this word mean? Reservoir. Reservoir of what? And one thing I've realized from thinking about this, you know, I used to think, what's a reservoir? Okay, it's a reservoir of energy, a heat bath, or a reservoir of particles. You know, when you do statistical mechanics and do different ensembles, your reservoir is always transferring something physical, energy or particles, with your system, right? But what we've realized from thinking about thermalization and many-body localization is you can get rid of all conserved quantities, energy, particles, et cetera, and you still have reservoirs and failures of reservoirs for localization. And so it seems the essential feature of what a reservoir is to cause a quantum system to go to equilibrium is the reservoir is something your system can get entangled with. That's the important thing, to exchange quantum information with, to get entangled with as much without any limit. That's what a reservoir is. You don't have to exchange energy or particles. That's not necessary. Okay. So now I got to talk about subsystems. So again, here's our system here, isolated from its environment. All right, and inside of it, I look at a subsystem. Okay, and we have to actually ask what subsystems are we talking about? And I need my subsystems to be defined by local operators. And this is local in the sense that the quantum information people use that word, meaning in terms of the So there's operators which are local in real space in my system. And whatever the subsystem is, I can define the degrees of freedom in the subsystem by operators that are finite order composites of the local operators in the full system. Just for thinking about this without worrying about the details, think of my subsystem of being just a local region in real space. But it doesn't have to be, right? So it could be some particular states in momentum space, or just so. I don't mean that restrictive, but you can't take just any subsystem of the full system, because the full system has a Hamiltonian, and the Hamiltonian has eigenstates, and there are these operators which are just projection onto the eigenstates, which all commute with the Hamiltonian. So every quantum system has an enormous set of conserved quantities, trivially, just projections onto the eigenstates. And we don't want our subsystem to be defined by those operators, because otherwise it won't thermalize, right? And so one needs rules of what subsystems you're talking about, such that you exclude just projections onto eigenstates. Okay, so now I've got my full system here, the subsystem I call S, and S bar is all the degrees of freedom that are not in the subsystem, right? So I've just partitioned my full system into two parts, a small part I call S, and the rest I call S bar. And then we take a partial trace, so we take the state of the full system, we take a partial trace over everything outside of the subsystem, and that gives me the probabilities in the subsystem, right? And so this is what's called the reduced density matrix, or reduced density operator. Okay, and we can do that at any time, right? Okay, so that's for the state of the full system at a given time. This tells you what the state of the subsystem is, right? And then we can also ask about thermal equilibrium for this subsystem at a given temperature, right? So let's say for now, we've only got one conservation law, namely the energy, total energy, and so we're just going to pay attention to the temperature. So if we're at temperature T, and we look at the subsystem at equilibrium at temperature T, that's just equilibrium at temperature T, namely the Boltzmann distribution for the full system. So this is the Boltzmann distribution for the full system. Take a partial trace over everything that's not in the subsystem, and that's the equilibrium distribution for the subsystem. Note these are, you know, these are real full operators or distributions, right? Okay. And what we mean by thermalization, or so the strong version of what we mean by thermalization, is that for all initial states at a given energy density corresponding to this temperature T, and for all accessible local subsystems, so local subsystems that are actually measurable quantities, as you take the thermodynamic limit on the full system, the long time behavior of any initial state as measured on the subsystem will be identical to equilibrium at that temperature. Right? So here, so note, for it to be a sharp feature, we have to take the thermodynamic limit. So we take the thermodynamic limit where the size of the full system goes to infinity. We need to do that so that the ratio of the number of degrees of freedom in the subsystem to the number of degrees of freedom in the full system goes to zero. So it's best to think of keeping the subsystem finite as you take this limit. If you want to then do a big subsystem, take the full system to infinity first before taking the subsystem to infinity. The infinite time and thermodynamic limits have to be taken together in order for this to be true. First of all, okay, so this is systems that do thermalize obey this, right? There are also systems that don't thermalize that don't obey this. But for systems that do thermalize, you know, this is true. Okay, you have to take both limits, time to infinity and the thermodynamic limit together for the following reasons. Okay, so if I didn't take the thermodynamic limit and I just had a finite system, then its dynamics is quasi-periodic. It's a finite system with a finite number of degrees of freedom, a finite set of eigenstates, and its dynamics is quasi-periodic because it just has a discrete spectrum. And so there is no limit T goes to infinity, right? There is no such limit. So, but right. If we take the thermodynamic limit first, the system will get big, and the time scale to diffuse just conserved quantities across the system or let entanglement spread across the system will go to infinity. So you have to take the two limits together such that as you take the thermodynamic limit on the system, you take the time to infinity faster than any time scale of how long it takes quantum information or conserved quantities to get across the system, right? And for typical systems, that would just be diffusive timescales. Okay. Now, I put this little proviso here. I've given you a strong version of this, all initial states and all subsystems. Those of you who know about these things in mathematical physics, there's often these weaker statements where you say almost all, which means all but a set of measure zero, and that we don't really have any strong evidence that we need the all as opposed to almost all, because you know, in order for you know things in the lab to thermalize, you don't. It's okay if there's a set of measure zero of initial states that it doesn't thermalize for, because they'll just never come up in the lab, right? So these are some questions that are around. Is you know when we talk about thermalization, is it really true? Where it's true for all subsystems and all initial states, or are there special subsystems or special initial states that don't actually thermalize, but are a set of measure zero in the thermodynamic limit? I personally, because I just can't think of good exceptions, I personally am more comfortable with the all as opposed to the almost all. But if somebody came up with a good idea of some exception which sounded very plausible, there's you know there's really nothing proving that that can't happen at this point. Okay. Okay, so if we accept this statement is true for some system, which is really what you're assuming when you do equilibrium statistical mechanics and say it applies to my system if I wait long enough. If we assume this, you get an interesting consequence, which is this eigenstate thermalization hypothesis, which some of you may have heard of. So I'm going to tell you about that. Okay, so this is an idea that came out of a different thread. So there's also a thread of research which is nonlinear dynamical systems and classical chaos, and then quantum chaos of things with a few small number of degrees of freedom, and then going to many-body physics from that, right? And that's when the eigenstate thermalization hypothesis was first formulated. Josh Deutsch had the first version of it. Mark Shrednicki carried it a lot further. Hal Tosaki. So these are the names from the 90s. Okay, and you know, I'm just presenting it one way. There's many different ways of presenting it, and even many different ways of precisely defining it. We think they're all equivalent, but it's, again, this is not entirely clear at this point. So this is my way of presenting it. So given we have a system that thermalizes, if all initial states thermalize, let's consider the eigenstates of our Hamiltonian as an initial state, right? But eigenstates of the Hamiltonian are time independent. So therefore, if all states thermalize, then the eigenstates must all be thermal, because they don't change with time, and if they're thermal at long time, they have to always be thermal. That's in some sense the eigenstate thermalization hypothesis. So here's our Hamiltonian, there's an eigenstate. So now I'm talking about many-body eigenstates of a many-body system. There's the eigenenergy. And so the eigenstate thermalization hypothesis can be written this way. You don't need the dynamics because we're talking about time-independent states. And so what you do is you just take an eigenstate of the full system's Hamiltonian, take the trace over everything outside of your subsystem, and therefore get the state of your subsystem if the full system is in this eigenstate n, right? So that's rho sub s super n. And the eigenstate thermalization hypothesis says this is equal to the equilibrium state of that subsystem at the temperature T sub n, which corresponds to that eigenenergy. Right, that the expectation value of the Hamiltonian at that temperature is equal to this eigenenergy. Right? And the strong version of ETH is this is true for all eigenstates and all subsystems. All subsystems, again, with the restriction that they're local in a certain sense. Okay. So this is a strong claim. Like thermalization is also a strong claim. Both of them are very hard to test because we're talking about the long-time, real-time dynamics, in the case of thermalization, of a quantum system. And integrating quantum systems forward in time is a very challenging problem, both theoretically and numerically. And getting eigenstates of, this is a statement here about the exact eigenstates of a many-body system, highly excited eigenstates. Getting those is very hard. Okay. And the business with saying all and everything, it's actually a stronger statement that's needed than is needed for thermodynamics and statistical mechanics to be true. All you would need there would be an almost all. But at least to the extent we've looked for exceptions of ETH by looking for the eigenstates that behave the worst in terms of comparing to thermalization, it looks like in the thermodynamic limit, they all behave the same. Even the worst case gets better as you take a larger system. Okay. So it appears to be true for many systems that you can study, but the data is from exact diagonalizations of Hamiltonians, and those of you who know how to have any experience doing exact diagonalizations of generic quantum Hamiltonians, you know you can only do like 16 spins. You know, we're not talking about the ground state. We're talking about highly excited states gotten out of the middle of the spectrum where the spectrum is very dense. So you can't use a lot of the tricks that are good for getting ground states. And so, you know, typically studies of this, the highest they might go is 20 sites, 20 spins, that kind of scale, and usually less. So it's these are strong statements. They've been tested to a certain extent, but we shouldn't believe them too strongly because the evidence supporting them is is not that strong. But they do have an appealing simplicity. And there are, as I'm going to say later, there are systems for which these statements are definitely not true, and those are the Anderson localized systems. Okay. So let me just say a little bit more before I get to Anderson localization. So when the eigenstate thermalization hypothesis is true, it actually provides you with a new set of ensembles for doing statistical mechanics that, just like all the other ensembles, actually does give the correct thermodynamics because a single eigenstate is equilibrium. And I call these the single eigenstate ensembles, or we could call them single eigenstate microcanonical ensembles. So when you've either taught or learned statistical mechanics and they teach you the microcanonical ensemble, you often say, oh, the microcanonical ensemble is equal probability for all energy states in this energy interval, right? And then you say, oh, how wide should I make that interval, right? And there's nothing good to say, right? It's, when you teach it, it's kind of annoying because you don't have anything helpful to say about how wide to make that energy interval, as long as it's sort of order one or something, or even less. But this says, gives you a natural answer to that question. Make it as narrow as you can so it only contains one state of the system. And that's fine for doing thermodynamics and statistical mechanics if the ETH is true, right? So that's a new way of doing statistical mechanics, single eigenstate statistical mechanics. A single eigenstate doesn't sound like an ensemble, right? In the basis of the eigenstates of the Hamiltonian, you wouldn't call it an ensemble, it's just one state. But in any other basis, the eigenstate is some complicated probability distribution, and so let's just view that as an ensemble, a probability distribution, right? And so I'm advocating that as another way of doing statistical mechanics. And as I'll show you, if you do your statistical mechanics that way, as opposed to the traditional way, you're going to find a whole bunch of phase transitions and new quantum phase transitions, et cetera, that you can't see with the old versions of statistical mechanics. Because these ensembles can see Anderson localization, and they can see the nature of the localized eigenstates and whether they break symmetries, whether they have topological order, all that kind of stuff, which is completely invisible to equilibrium, to old-fashioned equilibrium statistical mechanics. Okay, so that's one statement. I'll elaborate more on that. Another comment here. So if we have a system satisfying the eigenstate thermalization hypothesis, it means all the eigenstates look like equilibrium, right? And so if you want to make a state, of course, you can just expand it as a linear combination of eigenstates, and you think, oh, well, then how could that be out of equilibrium? How can I take a whole bunch of equilibrium states and add them up and get something that's out of equilibrium? And normally you can't, but to be out of equilibrium, if you add them up very specific ways with very special coherence between the states, so you add them up with just the right phases and just the right amplitudes, you can make an out of equilibrium state, such as, for example, a temperature gradient or something. But it requires very fine-tuned coherence off-diagonal in the density matrix when written in terms of the eigenstates of the Hamiltonian. Right? And of course it requires fine-tuning, because to be out of equilibrium, you're at lower entropy than equilibrium, right? And in order to be at lower entropy than equilibrium, you've got to tune things very carefully. That's what lower entropy means. There's a whole bunch of constraints on the system that are, you know, keeping it from having high entropy, right? So for systems that satisfy ETH, being out of equilibrium is just a certain very special type of coherence. But then these off-diagonal terms in the density matrix, with time, they just pick up these phase factors, just e to the I en minus em times t. That's just unitary time evolution. And the special coherence you started with gets scrambled, and that's dephasing. Right? When we say dephasing, we just mean the special phase relations you had at the beginning, which gave you a special property, got messed up because of these phase factors changing with time. And at long times, they become more or less random. So in this language, equilibration, going to thermal equilibrium, is really just dephasing. And the eigenstates are all at equilibrium. And so the only way to be out of equilibrium is due to having these special phases. And then you just lose them with time. And that's why the system goes to equilibrium. OK, so that's what I'm going to say about thermalization before I now go over to systems that don't thermalize, namely systems that are many-body Anderson localized. So let me just pause here, see if there's any questions about quantum thermalization. No? Okay. Okay, but the eigenstate thermalization is false for systems that are Anderson localized. And such systems do not thermalize. They are not reservoirs for themselves. And here's an example, which we wrote about. This was Arjit Pal's thesis, was focused on this particular model. So we want to study many-body interacting quantum systems. We want to study as long a length scale as possible. And so we take the simplest possible local degree of freedom, just a two-level system, which we could call a spin a half or a qubit, or we could call it the presence or absence of a particle. And then we work in one dimension so that with the smallest Hilbert space, we can get to the biggest distances. And fortunately, in one dimension, we can study this physics because both the thermal phase and the Anderson localized phase occur in this model. Okay, so we just take a spin a half chain. So there's the Heisenberg spin a half chain, coupling J between nearest neighbors along the chain. And we put a random field. So this HI is a static random field acting on each spin. Each spin has its own random field. So I've drawn, you know, the spin on each field. Here in this model, we take them all along the Z direction. So total Z spin is also conserved, as well as energy. And just for specificness, Arjit chose to draw these random fields from just a uniform square probability distribution with support between minus H and H. So H sets the strength of the disorder here. Right? What matters is the ratio of H to J. Okay, so that's our model. We could view it as a spin model. We could also view it as a particle model. If we call spin up as a particle and spin down is no particle at that site, spin up is a particle at that site, then this here, this random field on the spin, is actually a random potential for those particles, because this sigma z is just the density operator at that site. There's the random potential. And then the z components of this is an interaction between particles on nearest neighbor sites. And the x and y components of this are the raising and lowering operators, and that hops a particle from one site to the other. So we have hopping interactions and a random potential when we think of this as particles. So it's also a particle model, but I'm going to talk about it as a spin model. Okay, so there it is again. Actually, did I emphasize that here? Sometimes when I write these Hamiltonians, I think I haven't done that. A lot of times when I'm giving these talks, and we're talking about an isolated quantum system, so sometimes what I like to do is I like to write the Hamiltonian and then put after it explicitly plus nothing else. Because a lot of the times when you treat a Hamiltonian, you just implicitly assume there's some heat bath, right? And you sum over states with a Boltzmann weight, or you know, do a path integral, an imaginary time path integral. A lot of the standard operations in theoretical physics, although we implicitly assume there's a heat bath around, right? And often you just don't even write it down, right? And so when I give these talks, I sometimes like to very explicitly say plus nothing else, just to say you're not allowed to do a Boltzmann average. You have to do dynamics, quantum unitary time evolution. Okay, so here's our Hamiltonian. Here's our static random fields. So this has a trivial limit where it's trivially localized, right? Just turn the interactions off, right? So we have the spins are not interacting with each other. Each spin is in a field, right? We can diagonalize that Hamiltonian. The eigenstates, all the spins are either up or down, parallel or anti-parallel to the field. It's trivially localized. There's no transport, so the spin, the sigma z, all the individual sigma z's then would commute with the Hamiltonian and be conserved. Any spin or energy on one site will just stay on that site forever, and that spin will just Larmor precess at the frequency set by its local field. So it's just a trivial system. But this is actually the beginnings of what the many-body localized phase looks like. And the eigenstates of that system are simply any pattern of spins up and down, right? And we could choose, if we just picked a random pattern of spins up and down, that has an energy that corresponds to infinite temperature, right? If the spins are just randomly up or down, that's like infinite temperature. But then you look at this eigenstate and ask, what is this spin doing? It's not like infinite temperature, because at infinite temperature, that spin should be 50% probability up, 50% probability down. But in this eigenstate, it's up, and this guy's down, right? So those, you know, we can consider a subsystem, which is just one spin, and the subsystems are clearly have probability distributions totally different than the equilibrium at that temperature, right? So ETH is false. It's just trivial. Okay, so now what we do is we add the interactions, right? And what happens is this picture basically remains unchanged. The states remain localized. This was proven in this for not this model, but something morally equivalent to this was shown to all orders in perturbation theory by Bosco Elena Altshuler. John Imbrie, who is a mathematical physicist, again, not for this model, but a different spin chain, has just recently produced a rigorous proof of many-body localization. That was just posted, again, earlier this month on the archive. And we looked at it numerically, looked at this model numerically. And what happens when you add the interactions? Okay, so before I had this interaction, this Hamiltonian had a whole bunch of conserved quantities, which were just the z components of each spin. And they all commuted with each other, and they commuted with the Hamiltonian. And what happens when you add the interactions is you still have the same number of local conserved, localized now, conserved quantities. You just take that conserved quantity and dress it with some quantum fluctuations to make a less trivial localized operator, which is a conserved pseudospin. So this is something we've outlined in 2003, and Dima and Zlatko and Maxim Serbian said this, and a few other people. So in, a number of people have proposed this in 2013. And it's essentially what Imbrie has now proved. It's a conjecture. One of the challenges is to actually construct these pseudo-spins, take a particular Hamiltonian and systematically construct these pseudo-spins. This is probably feasible, but exactly how to do that numerically has not yet been discovered. But it's probably just a matter of time that some smart people will figure out how to do that. Okay. And the thing that changes when you do this is, just a second, I just want to say one thing. I'm going to answer the question in a second, or listen to the question, is, for j equals 0, these pseudo-spins don't interact with each other at all. But when we go to the non-zero j model, what happens is we get diagonal interactions between the sigma z's, the dressed spins. They start interacting with each other, but only their z components interact, so they still commute with the Hamiltonian. So the model does change in that it gets interactions. You can renormalize away the XY components of these spins by changing variables, but you can't get rid of the Z components of the interactions. Somebody had a question. Yeah. At small j, small non-zero j. Well, let's just say for today, it remains in violation of the eigenstate thermalization hypothesis. But I'm going to say a few more things. Okay, so on my next slide, probably, I'm going to list some of the distinctive features of the localized phase. But that's a very good question. I admit I have not said what that really means, but I'm going to say more about that. Okay, so this is Anderson localization with interactions at high energy. So most of the literature on Anderson localization is either about non-interacting particles, that's probably 90% of the literature, and the other 9% of the literature is about interactions but in the ground state, or very near the ground state. Whereas what we're talking about here, we're talking about strong interactions and in highly excited states, which is something which has only recently received much attention. Now, for small j, the system remains localized. In this model, if you turn up j strong enough, the system actually does become thermal and the ETH becomes true. And that we've seen numerically. Okay, so there's the Hamiltonian again. And I'm going to so what we're going to do, it has a phase diagram here. So this horizontal line is H over J, so that's the strength of the disorder relative to the interaction, right? And this is what I call, sometimes I call it an eigenstate phase diagram. So it's a phase diagram, but not thermodynamic phases, but phases where the eigenstates are different in some sharp way, or the dynamics is different in some way. The thermodynamics, the equilibrium behavior, doesn't show this phase transition, okay? And there's only one axis on here because what we often do in this field is we just work at infinite temperature, right? So our computers go through the work of finding all the eigenstates of this Hamiltonian, a large number of eigenstates, and if we just use all that data, give all the eigenstates equal weight, that's kind of like being at infinite temperature, right? Infinite temperature means every state has the same Boltzmann weight. I'm not saying the system equilibrates. I'm just, when I say T equals infinity with quotes, that's what I mean. I mean all states given equal probability. You might say all initial states are equally likely. And that's what we often do. So I don't have a temperature axis. I just have a disorder axis. Okay. Now this model here, if I turn H off, don't have the random field, I just have this Heisenberg spin chain, that's zero on this axis, and that's actually the first non-trivial quantum many-body problem that was solved. Hans Bethe solved that in 1931. That's the genesis of the Bethe ansatz and Luttinger liquids and all that kind of stuff. So there's a special point right here at zero, but as far as we know, as soon as you add a random field to that, it crosses over to a thermal phase where the ETH is true. The issue of how this crossover happens is a very interesting subject that people are actively working on, but I don't want to talk about it today. Wenwei will know that that's a hard problem since he worked with me on that for a few months and we made absolutely no progress. But over here, okay, so we have two phases. We have the thermal phase and the many-body localized phase. And we have a quantum phase transition between the two of them, whose position, you see, has big error bars on it because this is gotten from numerics on spin chains of length like 16 spins or less. And doing finite size scaling for a phase transition whose theory and finite size scaling theory we have no clue about. So we were doing a finite size scaling sort of in the dark to estimate the transition. So this is an interesting problem. But let me just now, in answer to the question, just list contrasts between these two phases. So over here in the thermal phase, the system is a reservoir for itself and thermalizes its subsystems, whereas over here, it is not. Okay? Over here in the thermal phase, all local information in the initial state spreads through the entire system in the infinite time limit, so is hidden. The only way to recover it is to do a measurement which measures the whole system. You can't recover it by looking at subsystems. Whereas over here, in the localized phase, some of the local information in the initial condition remains localized near where it was in the initial state. Therefore, over here, my system is a type of quantum memory. Whereas over here, it's not a memory at all. It's useless for those purposes. Completely decoheres. And this is one of the motivations for interest these days in many-body localization, because perhaps there will be some kind of useful quantum memory that has an architecture somewhat related to this. Okay. Over here, the eigenstate thermalization hypothesis is true. Over here, it's false. The way we test it numerically is we just take our Hamiltonian, we diagonalize it, we pick up two eigenstates that are as close in energy to each other as possible, which is exponentially small energy difference in the size of the system. So those correspond to essentially the same temperature. And then what we do is we look at a subsystem, the simplest subsystem, just one spin, and compare the probability distributions in those two eigenstates. And when you're in the localized phase, you find they're just totally different. They differ by of order one, and you take systems of length 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, and it's just not changing. There's no finite size effect. It's clearly staying of order 1 in the thermodynamic limit. That's very clear over here. Whereas you do it in the thermal phase and you look at the difference, you find the differences are decaying exponentially as you take the thermodynamic limit, because the Hilbert space is growing exponentially. And in the thermodynamic limit, the two subsystems and the subsystems in the two different eigenstates will be exactly the same in their probability distribution. So that's a simple way to test ETH, not by comparing to a thermal distribution, but just comparing two eigenstates to each other. So it's a simpler way of doing a test. Over here in the thermal phase, the quantum entanglement spreads ballistically, and it spreads and leaves behind it an entanglement entropy that is the thermal entropy of equilibrium, right? Whereas over here in the localized phase, the entanglement spreads much more slowly, only logarithmically in time, and at least from many types of initial states, the final entanglement you end up with is subthermal. It's less than what you would have at equilibrium. So the system doesn't go to equilibrium. It's over here, this is a type of glass in the sense of remembering its initial condition, not going to equilibrium, right? Whereas this is like a liquid, which does equilibrate. In parentheses here, I've put parentheses because since I wrote this slide the first time, I've decided this is really just a side effect. It's not an important effect. Conservation laws are not essential to this distinction, right? So everything I've said so far, I don't need any conservation laws. I could, instead of having a time-independent Hamiltonian, I could have a time-periodic Hamiltonian, a so-called Floquet Hamiltonian. So there's no conserved energy. And I could take a different spin model, which has absolutely no conservation laws at all. Not energy, not particle number, not spin or anything. And you can still have such a phase transition. And it's really about entanglement properties changing and memory properties changing, not conservation laws. But when you do have conservation laws, over here, you get transport of any conserved quantity in this model, energy, spin. Whereas over here, the diffusivity, conductivity of the conserved quantities are strictly zero, even though you're at non-zero temperature. The isolated quantum system is a true insulator, not an insulator in the sense of the conductivity going to zero at zero temperature, but an insulator meaning the conductivity being strictly zero at non-zero temperature. No variable range hopping, nothing. That was the radical statement that Bosco, Elena, Altshuler emphasized, which really caught everybody's attention, bringing this subject back. Yeah. A quantumizing model, yes. Quantumizing model, yes. Okay, yeah, and in fact, I'm going to... So those of you who are going to come to the Four Corners tomorrow, so I'm speaking also at the Four Corners tomorrow, I'll be saying a lot more about this kind of stuff, and I'm going to talk about Ising models then. Imbri's proof, which I was mentioning, is for an Ising spin chain. Well, okay, so if you have, okay, so this is an interesting issue. If you have a model with continuous symmetries, it could have Goldstone modes, and the Goldstone modes will not be localized in the low energy limit, and that is pretty dangerous for localization, right? And so that's an interesting question, whether many body localization can ever survive in a system with, say, Goldstone modes or things like that. Naively, no, but maybe yes, right? Because if you have many degrees of freedom and it's strongly disordered and it's only in the low energy limit that you have these Goldstone modes and it's just a small number of modes, maybe the system can localize the Goldstone modes instead of the Goldstone modes thermalizing the system, right? So when you have a big system and a small bath, you sort of wonder, can the bath thermalize the system, or could the system localize the bath, right? And so these are issues that are really not clear now. They're interesting questions for the future. Exactly, right. It's just one mode, right? Really, strictly speaking, right? And so is that enough to thermalize the system? Right, but this is a very interesting question, and I really don't, I don't know the answer, and I'm not even sure I have a strong opinion about it. But my prejudice, weak prejudice now, is it's going to ruin the localization. But I'm willing to be disproven, because I don't want to insist on that. Other things I've thought about many body localization are looking like they might not be true. So it's a hard problem. Okay, so that's about this model. So next, I guess I should wrap up. So this is a little bit of a preview of my talk I'm going to give tomorrow at the, but let me just say the words. So we have this thing we're calling localization protected quantum order, which is having some sort of symmetry breaking or topological order. See, normally, if you have some kind of long-range order, either a topological order or some sort of symmetry-breaking type order, and you're at high temperatures in a low-dimensional system, it just gets destroyed by the thermal fluctuations, right? And so it can't survive, right? But in many-body localization, what happens is you don't have any thermal fluctuations. There's no bath. All the fluctuations are localized, right? And so it gives you a different way of stabilizing types of orders. Instead of something being protected by being in a ground state with a gap, which is what people often talk about in low-dimensional systems, here we stabilize the order by localization. There's no mobile thermal fluctuations which would destroy this order, right? And this can happen with, magnetic order, or it can happen with topological order. So there's a number of papers. Here's a couple of them. Another one from Berkeley, which I didn't list there, where you can, even at high temperatures and in low dimensions, have long-range order or topological order that's stabilized for to infinite time, and it's stabilized, protected by localization instead of by some sort of gap. And if you do single eigenstate statistical mechanics, look at the individual eigenstates, you can see when these types of orders appear. Because the system gets localized, it can get localized in a state that breaks the symmetry or doesn't break the symmetry, or it can get localized in a state with no topological order or with topological order, right? And there's a phase transition between those two things, all within the localized phase. And all of these phase transitions are invisible to equilibrium thermodynamics, because equilibrium thermodynamics averages over all the eigenstates, and all the eigenstates are ordered in different ways, and so when you average over the eigenstates, you can't see the order, because they're all ordered differently. But I'll tell people more about that tomorrow, if they want to come hear about it, at the Four Corners Conference. Okay, so now I'm going to wrap up, just say, summary of some of the things I told you about and a couple more open questions or issues. Okay, so this was a talk about the dynamics of closed many-body quantum systems. They can either thermalize or they can be many-body localized. There is this eigenstate thermalization hypothesis, which is a nice concept. And it suggests this single eigenstate statistical mechanics, which I told you about. I didn't say anything about experiments, so let me just say a couple words here. So, of course, thermalization is the norm, right? You know, that's why you've heard all about equilibrium statistical mechanics, but you haven't heard that much yet about localization, many-body Anderson localization, because what normally happens is systems thermalize. They're not isolated from their environment, et cetera. And so there's a question out there which people are exploring, which is, you know, what will be the best experimental system for investigating this many-body localization or this transition from localization to thermalization in the lab, right? And it could be, you know, cold atoms, cold molecules, cold ions. It could be some condensed matter system. There's some indications that this physics is happening near the superconductor insulator transition, where there's interesting stuff happening. It could be some quantum circuits, you know, that are being built for quantum information purposes. Might be one of the best laboratories for exploring this physics. Maybe NV centers. So there's any of these quantum systems that people are playing around with for quantum information purposes could be put to work doing some physics on this problem, as well as a lot of other interesting problems. So that's one issue. And it's really not clear right now. There's some nice work in the cold atom. The cold atoms is probably the field where this is advanced the furthest. There's some nice work from Brian DeMarco's lab at Illinois and a few other labs. But I'm looking forward to, finally, in the past year or so, we've really gotten a lot of interest in this field, and the experimentalists are starting to pay attention. So I think stuff's gonna start happening. There's another very interesting question. What if there's no randomness in the Hamiltonian? What if the Hamiltonian is translationally invariant? So for thermalization, we say, oh, we don't have an external heat bath, but the system could be a bath for itself, right? So we could say the same thing for localization. We have no external randomness, but just let the initial state of the system be random and localize itself, sort of like a self-trapping, right? And there's a few models around which are being explored about this. And so there's a possibility that you can really have true many-body localization without any external disorder, just by the disorder being the randomness in the initial state. And this is kind of an analog to the structural glass problem, right? Window glass, it doesn't have external disorder holding it frozen. It holds itself frozen, right? And so is there such a thing in this quantum problem? And so that's something that people are looking at right now. Okay, so I guess I'll stop right there. Thank you.
Thank you for that interesting talk. I'm trying to understand it intuitively, and I'm failing for the following reason. So there's something missing, I feel like, in what you've explained to us. If I consider extremely large H in the HJ model, then I could imagine that any given spin Hamiltonian is dominated by its local random field, so that's what it's going to abide by, and it will be localized.
Yes.
Whereas if H goes to zero, then we'll have totally non-localized physics. So the two extremes are clear.
Yes.
And then I want to just understand why, as I tune down H, should there be a sharp, what you call phase transition, instead of just some sort of continuous interpolation between those two extremes?
It
must be just that there's so many degrees of freedom, but you didn't talk about this part, and I feel like without that, I have no understanding of why this is happening. Thank you.
Well, okay, so let's start at this end, and let's turn on a weak random field, and let's just think about the thermal phase, right? So the thermal phase is just standard equilibrium statistical mechanics, right? The system, it's interacting strongly with itself. You just wait long enough, it goes to equilibrium, and what that means is the subsystems are at equilibrium. The system is being a bath for itself, right? So do you have trouble with that? Or, you said you could understand the limit, but, how about just a little bit back from the limit?
Sure. No. I understand both sides near the limits.
So you're comfortable here. So you're comfortable here, not just at zero, but a little bit away from zero.
Absolutely, sure. Right. Yeah, okay. The only thing I don't understand is why there's a sharp...
But here we have a sharp special property of this phase, which is the subsystems in the thermodynamic limit. You look at the subsystem in any eigenstate or any long-time state, they are exactly at equilibrium. Exactly at equilibrium, right? The deviation between the properties of the subsystems here and the equilibrium properties you get from statistical mechanics is zero in the limit. Right? And so we have something that's zero all the way along here for a long interval. And then way over here, it's non-zero. Right? So somewhere, it has to first become non-zero. And that's the phase transition. That's basically how you get phase transitions. That's how you argue you have phase transitions. You define a quantity which is clearly zero in one phase and non-zero in the other. And at some point, it has to first start being non-zero, right? And so that's, that's one argument for why there really has to be a sharp point where
the
thermalization
good.
Stops being true.
So then that reformulates the question or redirects it to asking why exactly is the deviation from thermality exactly zero? In other words, why is the eigenstate thermalization property true?
Yeah.
Well, it's only true in the limit, of course, right?
Yeah, it's only in a limit. It's in the thermodynamic limit. But, that's just really standard statistical mechanics, right? Just being defined precisely within the context of quantum mechanics. But, that's something that should have been taught to everybody in this room when they learned equilibrium statistical mechanics, right? Unfortunately, that's not presented that way because people didn't, I think in statistical mechanics course, people typically don't take the quantum mechanics so seriously, right? But, I think this should just be something that's in any basic textbook about statistical mechanics, right?
Except there's something quite artificial about this perfect isolation of the system. I would have thought a real physical system I normally apply StatMech to is not isolated from its environment. So there's other considerations that act to thermalize as well.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. But, let's let the, right, if it's coupled to something else, let's include it in the system. Right? Now, at some point, you've got to worry about the whole universe. But if you look at the standard expositions, which is pedagogically nice, of thermodynamics and statistical mechanics, an isolated system is pretty much the normal way of teaching that stuff, right? So when I introduce the isolated system, this is a long tradition of just following the way it's normally discussed. And it's conceptually nice because it's a clean description, right? But I'm not saying the ETH is proven in any circumstance, right? It's a hypothesis. It's been tested numerically to some extent. But when you actually get down to it, it is just the standard physics everybody believes. They just didn't, people tend not to follow the arguments to that logical conclusion. But I think it follows logically from sort of the standard understanding of equilibrium statistical mechanics. Not in any mathematically rigorous fashion.
I have two questions. One question is that for the integrable system, if that's an integrable system, kind of example, many about the localization. Another example is for the experimental example, should one stay with a solid, which always have a phonon, where the phonon is damaging for many about the localization?
That was sort of two questions, I guess.
Yeah, it's two questions.
There's a lot to say about localization. So the traditional localized models have an infinite number of conserved quantities, but they're not localized conserved quantities, right? They're typically densities, right? And so some people say the ETH can be, like as I defined it, it wouldn't apply to integrable systems because they have all these other conservation laws. But there's a way to generalize the ETH where instead of just worrying about the temperature, you worry about all the conservation laws, right? And so there is a ETH for integrable systems, which is all eigenstates which have the same density of all the conserved quantities. When you look at a subsystem, they all look the same, right? And then there's the generalized Gibbs ensemble, which is, so the Gibbs ensemble is just conserved energy and particles. The generalized Gibbs ensemble is conserving, worrying about all these conservation laws. So that's integrable systems. Now, the many-body localized phase is a different type of integrable system. So it has all these conserved quantities, but they're not densities, right? They're local quantities, localized, right? So the conserved quantities in the localized phase are operators near a point sort of with exponentially decaying envelopes in their definition, like localized states in Anderson localization. So it's a different type of integrable system. And it doesn't really have its own ETH, because if you specify all localized operators, you've specified the eigenstate, right? Unlike the traditional integrable systems where I can specify the densities of all conserved quantities, just the densities, and that leaves subextensive amounts free, and I have a lot of eigenstates which are identical in that sense, right? So whereas you don't have that over here. So there's no real generalized Gibbs ensemble that's useful for the many-body localized phase. So that answers about, right. Now, of course, in solids, somebody was asking about continuous spins, Goldstone modes, right? An acoustic phonon is a Goldstone mode, right? So in solids, you've got the same issue. Can many-body localization survive at all once you include coupling to the acoustic phonons? Not clear, right? In low dimensions, I could imagine yes, right? Because like in one dimension, in two dimensions, all the phonons are localized except the Goldstone mode, which is uniform, right? And so you could, is one mode enough to thermalize the whole system? Maybe not, right? But this is a very interesting question, which, people are just beginning to focus on, and it's a hard question.
Does this transitions also survive strongly coupled? When you have strong coupling, you still see this kind of...
Yeah, you're right. No, this is strong coupling, right? H and J are equal. As long as it's short-range interactions and you're not coupled to any external bath, yeah. This is all the regime we're interested in here, this is all strongly interacting systems. There's really no small parameter near that transition.
Right. And another question is this type of transition also happen in the Thales model in two dimension?
In the
Thales model.
You mean like quantum Hall systems?
Yes.
So that's another question, right? So when you're in a quantum Hall system where the band has a churn number, you necessarily have at least one non-localized state. Is that enough of a heat bath to thermalize the system, or could localization survive that? So it's another question related to the other two we just discussed, which I think is an open question. Right? Could quantum Hall systems be many-body localized at a non-zero temperature? Not clear, right? Because it's a very small number of extended states compared to all the other states. Right?
For a given class of models. For example, this one, is there a notion of lower critical dimension where this transition occurs, or?
It occurs in one dimension. No, okay, yeah, the physics
well,
is-
this moment.
The physics, as far as we can tell, occurs in all dimensions. Yeah, there's no sign of a lower critical dimension or an upper critical dimension. But you know, I didn't say that here. So we've got this phase transition, which sometimes I call them eigenstate phase transitions to distinguish them from thermodynamic phase transitions. And you know, what are the universality classes? What's the scaling? This is something we're trying to figure out. You know, there's a number of ideas out there constraining it, but we really know very little about these, you know, just sort of these basic questions about that you ask about for phase transitions. But yeah, you know, when we got into this, you know, it wasn't clear. You know, some people, when we started it, they said, oh, it's one dimension, all the states will be localized, because you know, for the single particle problem, all states are localized, and so they thought, oh, we would never see a thermal phase. But of course, the thermal phase comes in, it's quite robust, it's very clear. You know, you go over here, another distinction between these two phases is the many-body level statistics. Over here, the eigenvalues have level statistics of a random matrix. It's very clear, whereas over here, they're Poisson. So it seems to happen in any dimension, right? And single particle localization has a lower critical dimension of 2, but it doesn't have an upper critical dimension. And that's one sense why the theory of it's a lot harder, because there's you don't have this other approach. Here we have neither. So, you know, how are we going to even begin to, you know, we don't even have a mean field theory, much less a Landau-Ginzburg theory or anything like that. And so how to approach this phase transition in any even pseudo-analytic fashion, it's not clear what to do.
You said there is also some very interesting physics or crossover close to the beta point.
Yeah.
Could you mention a little bit more about it?
Well, it's a question, is it just a crossover? Is there some interesting intermediate regime here? So there's something people call pre-thermalization, which is, you know, if you have an idea for how there's some well-defined intermediate regime with a big dynamic range, which is neither fully thermalized nor fully integrable, people call that pre-thermalization. And you know, there are some models where there's numerical evidence that there is such a regime. But this is, you know, there's probably a lot of different cases, because there's, you know, a lot of different ways of being integrable and a lot of different ways of breaking the integrability. But that's a big subject.
For example, is it somehow useful?
Most of the questions are still open there.
Just a naive question. Is it somehow useful to have all these beta states? Can you somehow follow them adiabatically by turning off H and use the fact that you know the eigenstates exactly when H is zero? Can this be useful, or?
I don't think so, because no? I think as soon as you move away, you know, the beta ansatz has this special property of non-diffractive scattering between the particles. And I think, as you know, breaking integrability is just destroying that. Right, and so immediately, all those, you know, you have all these states which are near degeneracy, and immediately they're going to mix into into something very complicated. I don't know, but you know, it's a challenging problem, and you know, I suspect, you know, if there's something to be learned there, it's something that's going to probably be learned in the next years or so, because there's quite a few people thinking about it. But it's an area. My attitude in this problem is basically, you know, I'm interested in this physics and I stay away from integrability, because there's, you know, integrability is a very technical subject and there's people who are such experts on it that, you know, it's best to leave it to them.
So can you elaborate a little bit more on the connection between these many-body localized phases and glassy phases? You mentioned that a couple of times. Are they the same thing, or are there differences?
Well, certainly there are differences. You know, like if we take the spin glass, the traditional spin glass, that's a symmetry breaking, right? That's a type of magnetic order in a random pattern, you know, in a pattern specifically chosen by that system. And I believe... Well, okay, so tomorrow I'm going to talk about this a bit. Certainly you have, in the regime where there is no equilibrium spin glass order, so you're in a disordered phase, you can be in a model that would be a spin glass. You can either be thermal or you can be many-body localized, and you can even be many-body localized with dynamically stable spin glass order, which is not thermodynamically stable. And then if you go into the spin glass phase, I think in the spin glass phase, ETH could be true or it could be false. So I think the question of whether or not you have spin glass long range order and the question of whether you have many body localization, these are just two different questions, and the answers could go either way. Although they tend to be correlated, the more disorder you have, you know, the more likely you are to be a spin glass and the more likely you are to be localized, but I think it can go either way. Now the structural glasses, you know, they have acoustic phonons. You know, the normal picture of structural glass, people simulate it with classical physics and they seem to get a lot of the physics right. And so those systems are not quantum localized, right? So the traditional story of structural glass, quantum mechanics plays no role. Neither does Anderson localization. But it sort of makes me wonder whether there might be some materials where the quantum physics of Anderson localization could be somehow enhancing the glassy behavior. Or maybe in some magnetic materials, when it freezes up and acts like a spin glass, could that be more due to localization than due to the, you know, Sherrington, Kirkpatrick, Parisi type spin glass ideas, right? And but you know, these again, this is just speculation. You know, there's really nothing very specific, but it makes, you know, makes me wonder whether some of the glassy physics that people have been studying has underneath it helping it some of many body Anderson localization. But it's just a speculation. We got one down here.
So I have a question about the conductivity in the many-body localized phase that it's usually defined as an equilibrium property. And so the question is, in what sense do you talk about conductivity if you don't have like a well-defined equilibrium or statistical mechanics?
You can do the conductivity various ways. You know, you can hook up two leads and ask how much current flows. You don't have to assume it's near equilibrium, or you could do a Kubo formula for a given initial state. And,
I see. Okay.
So there's ways of defining the conductivity that don't rely on being at equilibrium. But I think over here, if you just averaged over all the localized states with a Boltzmann distribution and calculated the conductivity, you'd still get zero, right? And so you could just use your equilibrium definition. You know, it's okay over here if you want to do a Boltzmann average, as long as it doesn't affect the answer. You know, all the states have zero conductivity, so if you Boltzmann average over them, you will still get zero conductivity. Right?
Any more questions? Okay, then let's thank the speaker again.